Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Don Bailey, Christy, Distinguished Fellow at RTI International and former director of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, about Fragile X syndrome, the most common genetically inherited intellectual and developmental disability facing children in the United States.
I know. It'll be an important conversation for us to have, since so many people don't even know what it is.
Well, they will soon. And speaking of don't know what it is, we've got some research that matters. That's interesting, I think, and affects virtually every family and listener out there.
We're going to talk a little bit about training doctors to talk with dying patients.
About types of diets that might lower stroke risk.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the flu shot.
Just a little bit's coming on to play. But let's first talk about this research that was in the Journal of Clinical Oncology about how our colleagues talk with patients who are dying.
Well, I mean, the sad fact of the matter is that doctors in lots of different studies have been shown to not be very good at delivering the tough message, you are going to die. That's true for you have cancer as well. I think we, in various studies, have shown that we'll choose statistics or words like tumor or mass or CPR to save your life or various things that may be misleading because they're easier to say than something like you are going to die.
Or just that you're dying, because we're all going to die, right? I mean, and so this whole process of it's tough because, you know, we don't really know. Christy and I, we both are seen enough to know that we can't really fully say when someone's going to die, but we can say when some people are dying. And we think that they don't have all that long, whether it's weeks or months to live. So this was interesting research where these researchers wanted to see if they could train doctors to really deliver better news to dying patients, listening, talking, and they developed a training program that involved a 1.5-day workshop where the doctors worked on communication and then a coaching session where they got feedback to see how they were doing.
And to see if the program made a difference, they videotaped the 41 doctors doing some counseling with pretend sort of actors who are pretending to be sick. And then half of them had the training and half of them didn't. And then they were videotaped and assessed in their communication skills later on. And of course, the people who got the training did get better in their ability to talk with patients.
Yeah, they specifically got better at their ability to talk about this transition to end-of-life care, to talk about living will and wills and power of attorney and this dying and quality of life, this communicating about this just in general, about the issues that are dealing with end of life.
Oh, and Adam, I know both of us do a lot of teaching in our hospital work and in our residency program about how to have these conversations. You know, we do it through video reviews and we do it through individual mentoring. But it's a really hard thing for all of us as doctors and particularly new doctors to be able to say those words, especially when we don't know exactly when that would happen.
Yeah, I think this is really tough. You know, in their commentary, they said this was a short, feasible, and effective approach. And I do think it's promising. You know, and you might say, well, everyone could just take 2 days and get this training. But these were with simulated patients. Mm-hmm. And it's a real difference delivering it when it's real and you're dealing with the raw emotions. And I think it's very difficult sometimes if you've never experienced a lot of loss. It's also hard. So I think training is part of this. But I think this coaching that they brought into it is equally, if not even more important. Role modeling.
It's true, role modeling. And I'm so glad that's a part of our training of young family doctors, the role modeling part and the videotaping. But I think it's also about relationships and how to have those relationships with your patients and have tough conversations and thinking about what's best for them and their values. And that stuff really resonates, I think, with primary care doctors who value those relationships.
Yeah, and I think if one of our listeners out there, you know, you can help your doctors, you can help us. I mean, you know, it's hard enough to say the words tumor and cancer and fatal and dying. And yet, same time, we want to communicate and have the words hope and belief and faith. And like Christy, you mentioned companionship and relationship and listening and love. And boy, we don't talk about those all that often in the encounter. And so we've got to talk about both of those things.
Well, I think it's important. I said something to an intern the other day. You know, these are words like we're evaluating your mass or your tumor. And I'm like, has anyone said the word cancer? And if you're a patient or a family member out there and you feel like doctors are using words that maybe aren't just talking about what we're talking about, it's a good thing to say, are we talking about cancer? Are we talking about dying? To really push us as a medical community to be honest and have the real conversations.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, because this is going to be something that's ongoing. I know we're going to have some guests coming up in a few weeks to talk about some of these issues. But let's talk about this next research that matters, Christy, that looks about stroke risk, because I think stroke is one of those things that people really fear. And here there's some research about maybe a change in the diet that might have some impact.
Well, I love these studies that we talk about, Adam, about diet, because that's something that eating well, you know, it's not a medication. It's something just natural in our earth that we can do to be healthy. And in this case, a study published in the journal Stroke looked at
good
10,
name of a journal.
Yeah, it is.
I wonder what it's about in that journal.
Not your casual read. But it was an analysis of 10 different international studies and 200,000 middle-aged and older adults to look at their diets and their and an association with having a stroke.
Yeah, and those who had diets that were higher in potassium, greater than a milligram a day, each 1,000 milligram increase decreased significantly their chances of getting a stroke over the next decade. And, you know, you'd say, oh, well, we know that high salt diets, the high sodium diets are bad, but here we have a high potassium diet is good. And I guess my first question was, well, I'm not talking about taking a potassium supplement, am I?
Well, no, the foods that have high potassium in it are beans and certain fruits and vegetables, low-fat dairy. So some of the same things that are just healthy choices all around, and they happen to have more potassium in it as well.
And then if you were on a medicine like a diuretic for high blood pressure that can deplete your potassium, it's really important then that you keep your potassium levels higher than what they would be if you weren't taking supplements or you weren't getting a high potassium diet.
Yeah, having low potassium can be harmful, but it also can be very harmful to have a high potassium. So if you're on a medication, you should be working with your doctor to monitor that periodically. And this evidence, although you can't say it's cause and effect, is just another piece of information to say, let's make healthy choices with our diet.
Yeah, 4.5 grams a day or 4,500 milligrams a day is about what the Centers for Disease Control recommends in terms of potassium. So you can look at the amount of potassium you're getting in your diet and see whether you need to change it. Let's look at then our very last research that matters, Christy.
And this is just really a policy statement that the Center for Disease Control is urging all Americans to get their flu shots this year. We've been urging it on the show everyone over
so
6 months of age.
So not just those who are over age 50, those who have chronic heart disease, lung disease, renal problems, pretty much everyone over 6 months of age.
Yeah, which makes it a lot easier for us as doctors to
remember.
To remember it's everybody.
Well, and I think a lot of people say, well, why should I get it? I'm 23 and I'm healthy.
Well, I mean, and sadly enough, even in our own state, it's young, healthy people who've died from the flu, even in recent years. So this year's flu will have protection with H1N1.
The vaccine.
The vaccine will have protection against the various strains of flu, and it's important to get one as soon as one is available at your doctor's office.
So we'll talk about it soon, but not too soon. As soon as you see it being advertised, we certainly recommend that. And we've had a chance to not only talk about the flu, but talk about higher potassium diets are probably protective.
And a little bit about training doctors to talk openly with dying patients.
Let's have some more conversations about that really are difficult, but ones that are meaningful. So, Christy, that's going to conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Don Bailey about Fragile X syndrome.
You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking about Fragile X syndrome with Dr. Don Bailey. Dr. Bailey is a distinguished fellow at Research Triangle Institute International and former director of really the internationally known Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina. Welcome to our show, Dr. Bailey.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Bailey, Fragile X, you know, as we start to read, and as Adam and I were preparing the show, realizing that, you know, a lot of doctors, a lot of patients and people in the community probably don't know yet what we're talking about today. How did you get interested in this, and how do you explain to people what you do in a nutshell?
Yeah, so Fragile X syndrome has been called the most common disease that you've never heard of. I first got interested in Fragile X about 20 years ago when my wife's uncle was diagnosed with Fragile X syndrome, and that led to a number of other family members being diagnosed as well. So my research all along had been focusing on young children with disabilities and their families. And so in the early 1990s, I switched my research career to focusing almost entirely on this disorder.
And let's define for our listeners what really Fragile X means, because people know what the word fragile means.
Right.
They kind of have some sense, maybe X, or maybe they're talking about chromosome. But you put those two things together, I think it's like, scientific language. What is it, and why is it even called this?
So Fragile X has a very interesting history dating back into the 1950s. Some clinicians found a family that had 10 men who had very common characteristics. They all had intellectual disability. Their IQs might be in the 50 to 60 range. They had high levels of anxiety, and they were all related to each other. And so the syndrome at that point was named for the researchers who found it. Then over the next few years, quite a bit of research was focusing on the clinical presentations of these individuals until someone started looking at their chromosomes through a microscope. And when you look at the X chromosome through a microscope of someone who has Fragile X syndrome, it looks like a piece of that chromosome is pinched or even broken off. And so that's how it was named Fragile X.
Maybe you can give us a picture and we can post that on our website so people
sure.
can actually see that.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned the low IQ and higher anxiety of that particular family, but are those the most common features, or what are the most common features of Fragile X syndrome that we see today?
Yeah, so for men, males, that would be the most common characteristic would be intellectual disability and high levels of anxiety. Also, autism is highly associated with Fragile X. About 40% of individuals who have Fragile X syndrome also have autism.
So. Help us understand, because again, if this is not just autism, it's not just anxiety, it's not developmental delay, it's a constellation, a mixture of a number of different things in some people. So what exactly, I'm still trying to get my arms around it here, even as a doctor.
Sure.
Because you say it's the most common cause that we know of today of
Intellectual and developmental disabilities, what we used to call mental retardation. And so it's the most common inherited form.
Okay.
So Down syndrome would be more common. Autism would be more common. But those conditions aren't inherited, which means it's passed on from generation to generation.
And this is?
This is, yes. So Fragile X is passed on by carrier parents, most of whom have no idea that they are carriers. It's a flaw in the gene that gets worse from generation to generation. The risk of it moving, or what they call expanding, from being a carrier to having the full Fragile X syndrome grows from generation to generation. But most people who are carriers don't have any idea. And so so Fragile X is really relatively unknown still.
Until you have a child
has
this this constellation of symptoms.
And so a baby is born with or without this fragile X in their genetic makeup.
Right.
And then they go on, and how does this present itself? I know it typically presents at a young age, but how do parents and doctors start to recognize this?
Yeah, so Down syndrome is obvious at birth because children with Down syndrome have physical and facial features that are pretty apparent to any physician. Fragile X syndrome is not like that. Every child born with Fragile X looks like a typical infant. And so someone has to discover Fragile X, and usually it's over a period of months or years. Studies we've done show that on average, someone becomes first concerned about the child between 9 and 14 months of age because of slight delays in developmental attainment of developmental milestones. So sitting up, crawling, pulling to stand are all delayed by a few months in most boys with Fragile X. For example, the average boy with Fragile X doesn't walk until about 18 months of age, whereas typical children would walk at 12 months. But what happens is there's quite a range for all babies in terms of these developmental milestones. And so oftentimes development is not so out of line that it causes an immediate evaluation of the child. So there's often a kind of a back and forth between parents and pediatricians for several months, until finally around between 18 and 24 months, someone says, yeah, there is a problem here. A formal evaluation is done. And by age two, most boys with Fragile X are diagnosed as having a developmental delay. But the problem then is getting a genetic diagnosis. What's the cause for that developmental delay? Parents really want to get their kids into early intervention programs, and so that's their primary focus. Pediatricians aren't usually the ones who recommend genetic testing. They usually refer children to specialists, a developmental pediatrician or a medical geneticist or a neurologist, who then would do the recommendation for genetic testing. And so the average age of identification of the syndrome itself is not until about 36 months.
And we know with developmental delay, with both reasons for that, that early intervention is important. That's why we screen children when they come into the office and go through those processes to try to pick them up early. In this case, if it's because of Fragile X, does knowing it earlier make a difference for their future?
Well, certainly knowing earlier would provide entry into early intervention programs. Any child with Fragile X syndrome would be eligible for participation in early intervention. There's not been any research with Fragile X specifically to show that early intervention makes a difference, but it's been proven so many times with so many other conditions. I'm highly confident that it would be effective and would make a difference.
Well, and the difference between a parent voicing a concern at age 1 year and receiving a diagnosis at 3 years, there's a two-year period where I imagine many parents go through a tremendously frustrating process to find out what it is they're dealing with, worried that their child has autism, being told they have attention deficit disorder. And then you mentioned this developmental delay and intellectual disability. So there's this constellation. They may think that there's no end to it.
Right. There are a variety of concerns that parents have during this time period. But often they will get a different message from their physician saying, well, maybe, you know, he's probably okay. Let's kind of watch and wait. And so sometimes parents think, well, if my physician's telling me that my child is okay, maybe it's me. Maybe there's something wrong with me as a parent. And so you get that kind of issue. Most kids get into early intervention by 24 months of age, but they still would have gotten in much earlier if diagnosis had happened at birth.
When we talk about developmental delay and intellectual disability, can you just give two or three examples of the sorts of things that you as a specialist who might be evaluating a child would be looking at?
Right. So this would be, for example, talking. The first words by most children happen during the first year of life. The average boy with Fragile X syndrome might not speak until 2 or 3 years of age, and some even as adults are nonverbal. So we're talking actually about quite a range within the population, though some might have an IQ as low as 15 or 20, and have autism and self-injurious behavior, and others will be in the borderline intellectual functioning. Girls there's an even wider range of affectedness, and some girls have typical intellectual functioning and live normal lives. I should say one other thing about the problem with late diagnosis of Fragile X is that because it's an inherited disorder, if it's not diagnosed, parents are at risk of having a second child with Fragile X. And in the big studies that we've done, about 29% of families who have one child with Fragile X have another affected child before the first child is diagnosed. So this is unlike Down syndrome and other conditions where you might have one incidence of a disorder in your family. I know families that have four or five children with the syndrome, so it can be...
Yeah, I have actually family members on both sides of my family that have children with Fragile X, mm-hmm. one of which there are multiple ones within a family, mm-hmm. and it just blew me away given, you know, how much this transforms the lifetime experience of those people.
Right. Well,
we do need to take a short break, but I'm interested in following up on the conversation, particularly about those decisions for early screening. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Don Bailey, about Fragile X syndrome. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Adam and I have been talking with Dr. Don Bailey about Fragile X syndrome, and we're talking a lot about the range of when it's discovered in children, often with developmental delay and other behavioral differences, and a little bit about what the range of how this can look. But yet, so many people have no idea still, probably after our last segment, what we're talking about. Why is it that it's the most unrecognized, common problem?
If it's the most common inherited cause, and you would look at mm-hmm. something like muscular dystrophy, which might have similar numbers of people affected. I think there's 100,000 people that might have full-blown Fragile X in the United States.
Right.
But yet, muscular dystrophy, everyone knows about it. We may have mm-hmm. all given money.
Right.
I don't think we've all given money to Fragile X.
No, I'm sure you haven't. I don't know the reasons why Fragile X hasn't gotten the full airplay that a condition like muscular dystrophy has. Obviously, Fragile X has not had the superstar sports person or athlete or movie star who's been affected enough to come forth and talk about it. It's certainly not as common as autism, and so it doesn't get the cover on Newsweek and Time. But awareness is certainly growing. If you ask any physician 20 years ago, they might not have heard about it. I think just about any physician today certainly would have. But they might not have ever seen a child with Fragile X, and that's the problem.
Do you think there's a stigma with the intellectual disability piece of it or the genetic piece of it that it's different to talk about than, or the feeling state is different than when autism, we don't know what causes it. So there's a lot more questions
blame,
a lot to talk
less
about.
Blame.
Yes.
Is there some blame?
Right. Well, there used to be blame in autism, of course, but not anymore. I think that any parent who has a child with a disability feels some level of responsibility, whether it's an accurate feeling or not. In the vast majority of causes, it wouldn't be a reasonable thing to think that you caused this. In Fragile X, because it is inherited from a carrier parent, you can see why some parents would take the blame and say, you know what, I did this to my child. But most families that we study over the years, we found have a remarkable level of positive adaptation to Fragile X, and the biggest challenges they have are getting appropriate services, because what they want is a teacher or a speech therapist or a physician who understands Fragile X and knows what their child needs, and most of those professionals have never seen one, never worked with one before.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Don Bailey, a fellow at RTI International and former director of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, about Fragile X, and I know if I'm a parent, if a listener out there, Dr. Bailey, I wonder, I think I have it, but maybe I would like to get tested for mm-hmm. it. Or I know people who really maybe should get tested for this, some family mm-hmm. where there's intellectual disability or developmental delay. Tell us about screening. I mean, is this something that we can recommend, both genetic testing and screening? So those are really two different questions, I guess.
Right. So there's a lot of discussion and a little bit of controversy about that today. So right now, it's recommended that any child with a developmental delay of unknown cause ought to be tested for Fragile X. Likewise, it's recommended that any child diagnosed with autism also ought to be tested for Fragile X. So those are two screening or testing protocols that really ought to happen.
And the testing is a genetic test.
It's a genetic test, right.
Pretty reliable.
Very reliable. It's 100% accurate.
Is the reason they ought to be tested for it because then they know for when they grow up or then their parents know for thinking about another child? Or does it have something to do with any treatment option that could improve their life?
So right now, there is not a Fragile X specific treatment. Most children are treated with typical, you know, early intervention and special education services. And when they exhibit side effects or conditions like attention problems or hyperactivity or self-injurious behavior or anxiety, there are medications out there already that are what we call symptom-based medications, but they're not Fragile X specific. Interestingly, there's been quite a bit of research going on in the last 5 years on what are the core problems associated with Fragile X. And there is a whole new class of medications that that's been developed and are being tested by a variety of pharmaceutical companies right now that are designed to attack the core mechanisms affected by Fragile X. Those are in phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials right now. In animal models of Fragile X, they've been shown to almost reverse the effects. And so it's created quite a bit of perhaps unrealistic hope in many families. Nonetheless, people are very excited about this new class of medications, and you won't be eligible for them or if you don't know you have Fragile X.
Well, do we think that if you're diagnosed at age 1, that those drugs could work better than if you're diagnosed at age 3? Or do we have any reason to believe that that's the case?
We know for sure that the problems that occur in Fragile X start from birth. The few studies that have been done on very, very young children, if you look at brain imaging studies or early developmental studies, we know that these processes start going awry quite early. And so at least you would theorize that the earlier, the better for these medications. We could get into brain development, synaptic pruning, and so forth, dendritic pruning. These processes all get disrupted.
The brain is just completely developed fully, and there's no further development.
Right, and can you imagine someone who's 40 years old with Fragile X syndrome being given a medication like this, having lived as a person with Fragile X all his or her life? They're not going to, you know, be immediately cured overnight. So what we hope is that it would reduce the anxiety and open the possibilities for learning.
And so you're advocating, you hadn't said this part explicitly, but for having screening at birth for everyone or only for people who develop or seem to be slow in their development or have other problems?
Right. So one strategy would be, as you say, to screen once children have developmental problems. I think under the best case scenario, that probably wouldn't happen until maybe 18 or 20 months of age. By the time a child was affirmed to be delayed enough to warrant some genetic testing. And it wouldn't capture the whole population. It wouldn't capture mildly affected children. So should screening be offered at birth? We are conducting a study right now to answer that question. We're doing a pilot newborn screening study in Chapel Hill. We're offering voluntary newborn screening for Fragile X to all parents of birthing children at UNC Hospital. And we have sites in California and Chicago as well. The challenge is that the screening test also identifies babies who are carriers. And so ethicists ask the question, well, do you really want to know at birth if your baby is a carrier of a condition for which there wouldn't be any benefit to the baby at that point?
So if you screened 100 people that had the carrier state, only 10 or so might have the full-blown symptoms.
Well, it wouldn't be that many, but we think that about 1 in 4,000 children—
I'm sorry, 100 people who had the Fragile X carriers.
Right.
Right. So you can still, 9 out of 10 won't have full-blown, even if they're a carrier.
Exactly, exactly. So the incidence rate of carriers, it looks like from our study, is about 1 in 150 women and 1 in 500 girls and boys. So 1 in 150 and 1 in 500, whereas the number of affected children might be around 1 in 4,000 or 1 in 5,000. So most of the babies we're identifying are carriers. And so the fundamental question is that a good thing?
So also, who makes these decisions? I know we have to wrap up soon, but you're doing a study to investigate this and thinking through the ethical parts of doing any genetic test, which we should do.
Right.
And how do you see that? How soon will we have some clear guidance about that?
Well, we'll have some clear guidance about how families react to this information within the next year. We still won't have definitive data on whether earlier is better in terms of treatment. Mm-hmm. That'll require a prospective longitudinal study. So there's a lot to be decided.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Don Bailey of RTI International and former director of the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute about Fragile X syndrome. Thank you for the dedication and the sensitivity that you bring to really informing our colleagues and our listeners and patients. Thank you so much, Dr. Bailey.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with
you.
We
also have a great website. You want to mention it, Christy?
Sure. Well, I want to send folks to the website. We'll also link this to our blog, but www.fragilex.org.
That's the National Foundation for...
It's the National Fragile X Foundation. There's quite a bit of information for parents, for physicians, for teachers, for specialists. It's really a great source for current, up-to-date information. And also, there are now about 25 clinics around the country that specialize in Fragile X. One of them in our area is at Duke University. And so you could go to that website and get a national listing of all those clinics.
Fantastic. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls part of our show, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns, and thank you for writing us and calling us about these questions.
You can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, let's dive right in. We have some really interesting House Calls today that have to do with mammograms and confusion versus confidence of our listeners and patients.
Let's hear our first House Call.
Doctors don't seem to have as much confidence in mammograms now as they used to. And I was just wondering what is better and why have they lost some confidence?
I don't know if that's actually true. Doctors don't seem to have as much confidence in mammograms. I don't know if that's true or not. What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think it may appear that way, that we don't have as much confidence because of that U.S. Preventative Services Task Force sort of spacing out their recommendation that maybe having it every year is not as important. Maybe having it every couple of years after age 50 is the right spacing. And maybe in the 40s, there's not enough evidence for us to know, at least according to the U.S. Preventative Task Force, that mammograms in your 40s is necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, I think our patients and listeners are confused. There are different recommendations from the preventive services, from different guidelines groups and the American College of Radiology and others, you know, that may come out with differing recommendations in Cancer Society. And the doctors get confused, too. And when we get confused, we do, just like you, get frustrated. And I think it's a little frustrating that there are different recommendations. And so doctors are trying to follow recommendations, and you're trying to, as listeners, follow recommendations. And, boy, sometimes that leads to a little bit of frustration.
And I don't think there's a lack of confidence that mammograms are important or that mammograms are really helpful to catch breast cancer earlier and save lives. The change in recommendations more has to do with at what age should you start screening, how often should it be done. I think if you're over age 50, having mammograms and under the age of 65, having mammograms in a frequent basis every 1 to 2 years, there's good evidence to support that. It's on the older end and in the younger age that there's not as clear of guidelines, or at least not as much consistency in the guidelines.
So talk with your doctor, and hopefully you and your doctor get on the same page, and then that will make the confidence higher in both
yes.
of you. So and we encourage that.
Your family history and your values should be a part of that conversation.
Well, let's talk about values, Christy, because our next listener is heading off to college, and they're wanting to know, can they stop a medication? Let's take a listen.
I am about to go off to college, and I have a question. I have been on Cymbalta for several years to help with my mood and energy levels. Things are going great now, and I thought it would be a good time to stop the Cymbalta, seeing as I am starting college and may not need it anymore. What do you think?
Well, what do you think, Christy?
Well, I would want to know more about the history on Cymbalta. That's a medication that's typically used for depression. It can also help with certain pain syndromes, and is a great medicine for a lot of people.
Kind of stabilizes whatever is going on in some of these chronic conditions that sometimes when they're not on the medicine, may can get worse.
Yeah, my gut reaction when I heard you're starting college, if you were my patient, I would say, oh, you may not want to make that change. I would say, oh, wait, don't stop just yet. It may not be the time to make a major change right when you're starting a new phase of life.
When you're about to be free and independent and also not probably have as much monitoring and
the
support networks are changing.
Yeah, that may be a good time for you to stay on the medicine while you're finding a doctor or therapist or someone in the area of your college, making sure that transition feels okay, and then together with your physician, you can talk about coming off of it if that seems appropriate.
And coming off of it, I like that terminology, Christy, because it's not just stopping it. And these are medicines that if you've been on for a good while, you probably shouldn't be stopping them suddenly. You might go through actually some withdrawal symptoms. It's very common for any of these types of medicines where people can get nauseous and feel pretty bad for a couple weeks if you try to stop it suddenly. So talk to your doctor or your psychologist or psychiatrist.
Good advice, Adam. Okay, let's listen to our next house call.
Hello, good doctors. I have some petechiae. I asked some friends about it, and they said it usually needs to be seen, just in case. It has been there a while, getting progressively worse. What should I do?
That is petechiae. A great... I have so petechiae. Many questions.
Petechiae.
Petechiae.
Let's spell that one. P-E-T-I, petechiae. We'll go with that.
Something like that.
That's like bruising. Well, that's a nice way to tell it to people. It's bruises.
Yeah, it's like bright red spots from your blood vessels that are on the surface of your skin.
So, that are real small.
That are
and they get real big. We call them purpura. That's the bruising, really.
Yes. And these things can happen from so many different reasons. When I heard this at first, I thought, oh, well, if you had fever or if you were sick in any way and got those sorts of bright spots on your feet or on your body, then yes, you should be seen immediately because that could be a sign of, you know, being dangerously ill.
But most people are probably not going to be dangerously ill. And there's, you know, I've seen, Christy, people who've had violent vomiting. They vomited real bad and then they got all these little petechiae from busted blood vessels underneath their eyes, you know, 2 days later, and they're thinking, oh my goodness, I got this really bad thing under my eyes. I go, did you vomit recently? Oh yeah, I did. And that's reassuring. Or an athlete that gets petechiae on their ankles after they did a very strenuous run.
So it's not, especially if these have been slowly developing, then it's probably not a sign of some life-threatening illness, but I think...
You get them all over your body, and you've got a bad fever, and your hair's falling out, and your heart rate's really high. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, I think the fact that you've taken the time to ask us about it means that you should have a visit. And if you're having other symptoms, then you should go ahead and do that soon. And if those are the only things, then you can sort of run it by your doctor when you see her or him.
Good petechiae, though. We like that. We like the word. It's a very lovely word for something that's not so lovely.
Let's put a picture of petechiae on the blog.
Good idea, Christy. And let's talk about our very last house calls from a listener about something that's really common. Can you combine different common medications?
I have a question for your health. My son recently got his wisdom teeth out. The oral surgeon gave us instructions to use ibuprofen 600 milligrams 3 to 4 times a day for pain regularly and to use 1 to 2 Percocets 3 times a day for pain that still exists. My question is, if we can take the maximum dose of both medicines basically at the same time, or do we have to decrease both by half if we are taking them at the same time? I want to relieve my son's pain, but I don't want to kill his liver or his kidneys either.
So alternating Tylenol or acetaminophen and ibuprofen or Motrin or Aleve, they're all sort of similar. Alternating them is one of the most common things that we recommend when we're dealing with children and high fevers. To every 3 hours, if you've got a stubborn fever, then 3 hours you could take Tylenol and 3 hours later take Motrin and 3 hours later take Tylenol and alternate it in that way to sort of keep the fever down. And then if done at appropriate doses, that is generally considered to be safe. They work in slightly different ways and go through different parts of the body.
Yeah, but we don't think of it as much in adults as with children here. And so this, you know, interesting question that for your wisdom teeth, which is really painful, you know, your doctor gave you, said to take this Motrin, which is, you know, up to 3 or 4 prescription strength tablets a day, and then possibly the Percocet that has both painkiller but also acetaminophen in it at, you know, 5 or 6 pills a day. And so the question is that okay? And there's not a lot of data out there, but what there is appears in the short term that it, particularly if you do, like Chrissy just mentioned, the alternating, that it is probably safe in the short term.
Yeah, I think if you had liver problems or kidney problems or other things going on, that would be a different picture.
But because the liver is where the acetaminophen, we worry about the toxicity if you have problems. And with the kidneys, it's with the ibuprofen.
And the ibuprofen goes through both. But provided those parts are healthy and you don't have any other things going on, it's probably okay in the short term as long as you do it in the safe doses.
And in those, you shouldn't take more than 2,400 milligrams of the ibuprofen a day. And the acetaminophen, people get real nervous once you get above 3 grams a day. People start getting pretty darn nervous.
Hopefully that's helpful to you. We sure appreciate you guys calling us and writing us with your questions, and want those of you out there to share your questions and concerns. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can go visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, as well as follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Don Bailey.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.